Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Trita Parsi, author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, will join us to discuss the real causes of the protests in Iran. Policy analyst Leah Douglas will tell us why the dairy industry is being milked by the very organization that's supposed to protect the dairy farmers. Miami reporter Jerry Iannelli will explain what the Koch brother-funded organization, the Libre Institute, has been up to in Florida. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to run down all the big news stories of the week. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show, commercial-free, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me run down some of the biggest headlines of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, this week, the big story in D.C., and I guess, you know, we saw the return of the Senate to into session, I guess, earlier this week. Maybe that was last week. I can't even, they're all floating together for me. But the big issue, of course, is that there's a potential for a government shutdown coming within about, 4 or 5 days. And one of the parts of this deal is ostensibly going to be, or could be, a DACA fix. This is what the Democrats want. Or they want a clean DACA bill and then do a broader comprehensive immigration reform. And so there's a lot of negotiations and talk that is going on. How much of it is sort of real or substantive is up to debate. But this week, Donald Trump convened leaders from the House and the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, ostensibly to negotiate this. And there was an amazing exchange, and I know you know which one I'm talking about.
Yep.
It was Dianne Feinstein saying to the president, Mr. President, we really think that there should be a clean DACA bill, and then we deal with border security in a comprehensive immigration bill afterwards. And Donald Trump said, yeah, absolutely, totally agree, clean DACA, that's what we want to do. We're going to do that. And then you had Kevin McCarthy say, who is the majority leader in the House, a Republican. But wait, Mr. President, I think what she's saying is different from what we want, right? And the president said, no, I think she's saying it, and like, because Donald Trump had no idea what the substance of what Feinstein was suggesting, nor the process of what Feinstein was suggesting, nor did he when Kevin McCarthy suggested. He had no idea what was going on whatsoever.
No, he didn't. And, you know, just to sort of set this up, the reason that I think most people agree, and it seems like the only possible reason he would do this, is that he set this up as sort of a televised, you know, negotiation pageant in order to, set people's minds at rest that he had not, you know, lost his marbles, which has been this topic of conversation for the past, 10 days.
Right.
Since the Michael Wolff book came out, Fire and Fury. And there's been a ton of discussion about that, and it keeps coming up. So he holds this meeting as a way to show that he's really in charge and that he's got it together. He hasn't lost it. He knows what he's talking about. And of course, if you watched it closely and understood what was going on, he made the exact opposite impression. Clearly, as you point out, he had no idea what he was talking about. I mean, it was obvious, and in his inability to sort of grasp the negotiating points. I mean, this is what he's supposed to be good at, right? I mean, this is his great talent, allegedly, and yet there was Dianne Feinstein saying something very, very clear. And to anyone, I mean, how else would you define a clean DACA bill? Anybody who's followed policy, even if you just read the newspapers, you know what that means, that it's a standalone negotiation and a standalone fix for the problem, and you're not going to combine it with a bunch of other stuff. That's what she meant. He didn't understand that. He comes out and agrees to it and even says, and he went further than what you said, he said, yes, that will be the first step. We'll do that, and then we'll come back later, and we'll do the other stuff. And it's like, that's when Kevin McCarthy went, oh, my God, he's agreeing to remove the DACA bill from the security portion. And, I don't think that the Republicans really care that much about the wall. That's Trump's thing. But they do care about, upping all the security, changing the immigration laws, doing all this stuff to really, because their base, this is their issue, right? I mean, this
yep.
is the thing. They are rabid about this. And if they drop the ball on that, if Trump did a clean DACA bill in that sense that Feinstein was proposing, they would have an absolute uprising among their base. So he knew what he was saying. Clearly, Trump had no clue. Even about an issue which is central to his, electoral win, it was everything, right? I mean, this was the issue. This was the thing that put him on the map. And here he is out there demonstrating for the entire country that he had no idea what's really at stake, what they're really talking about. He said, we're going to do a bill of love, he says. It's going to be bipartisan. He sounds like an idiot. And so I think that his attempt to prove that he was in command backfired eventually. But if I can just sort of digress for a minute and bring
before I know what you're going to get to, but before we do, I want to put even a finer point on this, because I don't know if everyone understands the problem from the Republican position with a clean DACA bill is that if you separate out DACA and it passes, that is the leverage point for the Republicans to get, things like a wall,
right,
or to get more. So basically, Trump, the master negotiator, was saying, I'll give you the thing that is the one thing that we have leverage over, and then I'll take your word that we'll do the other thing later. Which, so even if you didn't know, like even if he doesn't, and I would bet just about everything I ever have or will own that he doesn't know anything about the substance, you can just, the sort of the process of it, the roles these different things play, like someone must have sat him down beforehand and said, we want X and Y. You don't have to know what X and Y are. We want X and Y. And he couldn't even maintain that. It was as if he was just driven by, I want everybody to see that I'm being friendly to Dianne Feinstein. She's a Democrat and she's a woman. That's a twofer for Trump in that regard.
True.
He can show that he can reach out and actually respect a woman. And in fact, he admonished Kevin McCarthy when Kevin McCarthy said, oh, I don't think she's saying combine
right,
the DACA.
Right.
And he goes, no, I get what she's saying. And of course, he had no idea. So, all right, let's take a break here, because as much as we've just described this exchange and understand, this is the fulcrum of a 50-minute meeting about this topic. I mean, that's the fulcrum, right? That's it. That's where all the issues meet. When we come back, let's talk about how the press reacted to this, because I found that almost equally as astonishing. We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Digby. My name is Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Counting all different ideas drifting away. Past and present, that don't matter, not a future sorted out. Watch your moving in elliptical, but I think it's not what you say. What you say is way too complicated. Hey folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about, and really on some level this is a microcosm, but there is an ongoing fight now on Capitol Hill, an attempt by the Democrats to get some type of fix for DACA in the course of the negotiations for a continuing resolution or some type of funding of the government. And we're talking about a specific meeting that Donald Trump arranged purportedly to show him as being in charge, being on top of everything. And, you know, sort of like when Barack Obama had a big a meeting over health care. This was Donald Trump's version, smaller, of course. And he, in an exchange with Dianne Feinstein and Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, he demonstrated a total lack of ignorance about the specifics that they were talking about substantively and the role these different policies played in the negotiations. Like, it was almost like watching, you know, Kevin McCarthy attempting with the president, like watching a parent try and guide like a 3-year-old through a maze. Just like, oh no, you're walking into the wall over there. Just turn around like this way. Walk over there. Okay, no, careful, don't bump into that wall. And he was unsuccessful.
No, it's true. He bounced off the wall and basically fell flat on his face. And you know, this went on for a long time. I mean, I watched the whole thing from beginning to end, and my jaw was dropping through the whole thing. I'm going, what does he think he's doing here? You know, this isn't, you know, done. You made a big mistake. This isn't helping anyone believe that you are in any way competent. Now, you know, he didn't seem angry. He was kind of in a good mood, and he was, you know, sort of allowing people to talk, and he wasn't babbling incoherently about collusion or something. So, you know, he wasn't right at his worst. I mean, for him, it was a pretty good day. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, the bar is so low that if he, you know, if he isn't completely melting down, people go, oh, okay, you know, I guess he's all right. And that is exactly
he literally just had command over being able to tell people, you can talk now, and you can talk now,
exactly,
and you can talk now. That was it.
And that was it. I mean, he listened to both sides and sat there, and, you know, he said a lot of ridiculous things. I'll sign whatever you put in front of me. You know, it's like, really? That's Mr., you know, Mr. Donald Trump, build that wall? I mean, but whatever. You know, this was the best he could do, and you know, perhaps that's better than it might have been. But nonetheless, the response from the press it was outrageous. I mean, Danabash, who I think is the one that most people are pointing to as being the worst example, and I saw it in real time, and I tweeted it immediately because I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. He said that she gave him great kudos for allowing the press to be a fly on the wall, and she figured that she said, I'm not convinced it would have been any difference had the cameras not been in there, which is absurd. Of course, all the senators and
there wouldn't have been that meeting.
There was a camera there. And then I was just communicating with two Republicans in that meeting who said they had no idea that the cameras were going to stay in there as long as they did. Well, they may not have known ahead of time, but they sure knew it was happening when it happened. So there was a performance going on. But she claims that, you know, this was all very real. It was fly on the wall. And then she said, the bottom line is this is a year ago. This is the presidency that many people thought Donald Trump was capable of. We don't know if this is a results-driven debate, but just the notion of him being in command, of him wanting the cameras in there and wanting the cameras to see him sitting at a table, this is what people who had high hopes for the Trump presidency thought it would be, meeting after meeting like this. And she was really ecstatic and even said, you know, I'm going to be hit for this, but I don't care. And she wasn't alone. There were others who had the same impression. And I thought, my God, this is how low the bar is now. They've complained. And once again, you know, are we ready for the pivot? Is you know, after all we've seen over the past year, they are still eager to see this man kind of show that it's all been kind of an act, or that he was, you know, on a steep learning curve and he'd gotten it together, even though it's patently obvious that he is incapable of getting it together. And by the way, he hasn't changed in 35 years. He's not going to change now. He's 71 years old. He's not going to change. He is who he is. And yet they continue to have this hope that he's going to, you know, turn out to be the president, the presidency everyone thought it was going to be. Well, it is the presidency I thought it was going to be, and I knew you thought it was going to be this too. It's a complete chaotic mess, and anyone could have seen that, but the press for some reason continues this. Now, what's funny is that the next day after that Trump held another cabinet meeting, or held his cabinet meeting, and he was supposed to talk about issues, and instead talked about his reviews. He said, everyone's saying it was a performance. I call it work, but the reviews are great. You know? I mean, he actually said that. So, you know, this is where we're at. And, you know, he claimed that news anchors sent him letters telling him how wonderful he was. Maybe Danabash did. I wouldn't be surprised.
The amazing thing is that that's all Danabash was grading him on, was that he literally did not fall out of his chair, I guess, in the middle of this meeting. Like, the idea, I mean, it was really stunning. And you wonder if it's just this compulsion to find anything redeeming in him, or if there is really that vacuousness that is involved in the political analysis there. But look, we got to take a break. If you'll join me in the next hour, Digby, we have a lot more to talk about, not the least of which is on the immigration front, but obviously a lot more in the news this week. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back with Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, the president of the National Iranian American Council, Trita Parsi, on the real cause behind the protests in Iran. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. I know the score.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Trump's continued threats to kill the Iranian nuclear deal have a major impact on the recent upheaval in the country of Iran. Here to explain what's going on with the protests, the author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, Trita Parsi.
So, Trita, let's before we get to the protests that took place and then have seemed to have died down, I guess now almost 2 weeks ago, just give us a sense of, you know, because I don't think we hear very much about Iran and about the structure of politics there, to the extent that Iran gets any type of interest or recognition on in the media, it's generally they're either, you know, it's a question of whether or not they're upholding their end of the bargain when it comes to this nuclear deal. And beyond that, then, of course, they're a horrible, monolithic country that the question is whether or not we're going to bomb them. So just give us a broad sense of what the politics are in Iran these days.
Well, it's been very interesting because these protests have taken people by surprise, a lot of people by surprise, not because there wasn't a very dire situation economically, but because the protests came from a segment of society that largely has not been at the center of Iran's political development for the last 20 years, at least. And what that has now done is that, let me put it this way, the way it started was that conservatives got really upset that the Rouhani government was going to start cutting funding to Islamic charities that the conservatives control, that is like completely opaque, non-transparent, and was going to use that in order to put pressure on the on the conservatives. So what happened then is that they took to the streets. They organized protests in Mashhad, a conservative city, and were hoping to use that as an opportunity to put pressure on the Rouhani government. It completely backfired because ordinary people that were very frustrated economically took to the streets to show their discontent with the entire system, not just with Rouhani, but with the conservatives and the entire establishment. And things got out of control. The Rouhani government then believed that the conservatives broke a rule, that they crossed a red line in which they took their fight between each other to the streets. So now Rouhani is essentially giving them responding in kind and is kind of siding with the protesters, saying they have a right to protest, calling for the protesters who have been in prison, roughly 3,700, to be released, and saying that their concerns are not just economic, because that's where Rouhani is vulnerable, but it's actually political. It is social frustrations that they have. That's where the conservatives are vulnerable. And what's interesting with all of this is that it shows that some of the discipline within the government and within the ruling elite has started to fall apart because they're willing to use street protests against each other, even if it risks the entire survival or at least the perception of the survivability of the regime. It also shows that the protesters had leverage because they forced the country to have a conversation, force the elite to have a conversation that they otherwise would not.
It's fascinating that we're talking about mass protests that were, I guess, participated in by multiple people with very, very different agendas. What we're to understand?
Yeah, because everyone is frustrated more or less in Iran because of the economic situation and because of the political restrictions and suppression. But this was not an organized thing. This was not led by a specific individual or group of individuals that had leadership, etc. This is just a lot of people going out because they're frustrated. There was no unison of what they were asking for or anything of that kind, which really does show that the frustrations are very, very deep and diverse. But there has not been any organization that has managed to channel these frustrations and translate them into a political agenda with specific political demands.
Is there an, I mean, is how much of an opportunity is there for something like that to occur in a country like Iran? Like, if someone was to arise to lead some type of political movement, I mean, is Iran open enough that someone could do that organically? Would it have to be someone who is already in a position of power who sort of suddenly moves towards a slightly different position in terms of their perspective on society to organize something like that? I mean, where could that type of leadership come from?
There are protests in Iran, and there are those that are protesting that are outside of the system. The labor movement and others, for economic reasons, have been protesting for quite some time. But the government has a pretty strict control of these things, so it never really manages to grow to something big. And particularly if they start seeing that movements of this kind starts to develop a strong leadership, and that actually it starts becoming a much more potent threat to the government, that's when you definitely see the government clamping down. That's why it is much easier for movements to come out of the regime itself, whether it's the conservative or the green movement and the reformists. At the end of the day, they work from within the system.
Right.
Because they have the capacity to organize without necessarily facing the same degree of restrictions as those who are outside of the system would do. But at the same time, for elements from the outside of the country to be able to do these things is very, very difficult. They might be able to fuel existing protests, but actually being able to cause them, lead them, turn them into something really massive and powerful is very, very difficult. People inside of the country tend not to pay too much attention when it comes to these kind of things to elements outside.
So, I would imagine if I was someone within the system who witnessed what took place, I would start getting some ideas, right? I mean, if there's this large of sort of organic, spontaneous flash protests, I would start to think that maybe there's an opportunity here. Are there individuals that you are aware of, or that is widely aware of, or that people speculate about within the Iranian government, who may have looked at what just took place and said, there's a lot of energy there. Maybe I can harness it to do X.
Oh, there's certainly elements from the outside that have tried, and you have some groups such as the Iranian Mujahideen, a terrorist organization, that immediately jumped on this and tried to make it appear as if this was something that they were driving or that these protests were in favor of them, which clearly is not the case. There's also been a few individuals on the outside, one gentleman in California that has been sending messages into the country. He does have a big following on an app called Telegram that is very popular in Iran, in which he has been encouraging the use of violence and encouraging people to burn down banks, mosques, use Molotov cocktails, etc. That's part of the reason why Telegram, which is a Russian-developed app, actually closed down his account precisely because he was inciting violence. But I'm still not convinced that those elements on the outside are driving things. Will they have some degree of influence? Probably yes. But the bottom line is that people are frustrated in Iran for a variety of reasons, and they had expectations that things would be getting better after the nuclear deal, and economically things have not gotten much better. And there's that particular disappointment you have when not only things are bad, but you actually expected things to get much, much better, and that did not happen.
Right. That kind of dissonance between expectations and reality is, I think, sort of classically where you see mass protests and sometimes
exactly.
Revolutions. All right, well, we got to take a quick break. When we return, I want to talk more broadly about the implications of those protests on the nuclear deal, where we are on the nuclear deal, and get a sense of what's happening in this country relative to that deal as well. Trita Parsi, we'll be right back. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with the president of the National Iranian American Council, Trita Parsi, about his piece in The Nation, These Are the Real Causes of the Iran Protests. So, Trita, in the last segment, you were basically walking us through the nature of the protests that we have seen in Iran over the past couple of weeks and told us that it's really a disparate group of people who are frustrated. Largely, there's an undercurrent of frustration as a function of expectations that the Iranian people had that the nuclear deal would bring about. Before we pivot back to that deal, in part, I want to know what's stifling those, I guess, expectations from arising, but also, what's happening on this side of the ledger in terms of perhaps inhibiting and endangering that treaty. But I also want to ask, the way, it seems to me, or maybe just the way that we saw the protest ended, were massive pro-government protests. What is involved in that? Is that basically just the Iranian bureaucracy being able to say we can mobilize people? Is it also that there's just a large contingent of maybe a majority of Iranians who are not dealing with those, I guess, unmet expectations?
Well, the government has a long history of putting forward these demonstrations, and it does have the capacity of getting people out, because there is a segment, I would say it's a relatively small minority, that actually truly believe in the government. But you also have elements that, because they're working for the government, I mean, they might be government workers, not political appointees, they may feel compelled that they have to go out because it could have consequences for them. So I'll be frank, I don't put too much stock in those things. What I thought was more interesting was the large segment of the society that actually has been drivers of other protests, who largely sat out these protests, and that's the Green Movement. They have been at the center of most of the protests for the last 25 years. And they were not participants in this one to a large extent. I mean, most of the folks that I spoke to were taken by surprise. They were a bit worried about the situation, a bit skeptical about these protests, kept a certain degree of distance from them, sympathizing with the frustrations, but perhaps not with some of the methodology, et cetera. That to me was more interesting than, the fact that the government, as usual, manages to get some people to go out and protest in its favor.
Well, can you say more about that? I mean, were members of the Green Movement, were they, I mean, what were the tactics, I guess, that were making them concerned? Or was it just simply we were unprepared to capitalize on this?
I think it's a combination of both, but it's also because of the fact that we are now in a post Arab Spring environment in which people are a little bit more worried about what unorganized, undisciplined protests can lead to, in the sense that no one wants to end up where Syria is in today. So I think there's concerns of that kind that may have also been an important factor for many of these people not going out. But there's also an underlying reality that there are significant class divisions in Iran. The Green Movement never managed to get the working class to really come out and protest. I mean, their movement was a little bit more political and a little bit less economic. So their appeal to the working class was not always that strong. Folks I've spoken to in the Green Movement are very sympathetic to the plight of the working class, but at the same time, they're not entirely in the same boat. And one of the things that many of the protesters did this time is that they didn't just target the conservatives, they targeted the regime as a whole, and they even said that there's no difference between the reformists and the conservatives. I think that's also something that made it, some reformists feel a little bit targeted by these protests rather than recognizing that there's a lot of similarities in their demands nevertheless.
Interesting. And okay, so let's talk about what's happening on in the United States. There were these expectations, or I should say maybe we're sort of like moving towards the United States here, but there was expectations that in the wake of signing this agreement, industry, business, investment would come into Iran because there was a baseline of stability, I guess, brought about by this nuclear deal. The United States had less reason for some type of, you know, and people can debate, and I think I tend to agree with those people who think like there was really not much you could do. But the rationale for some type of limited strike, which could have spiraled into something, is less with a nuclear deal. So there was an expectation that there would be more investment. This investment didn't come. Why is that?
Well, there's many reasons for it. I mean, the Iranians have problems and there's corruption and the IRGC is playing a very negative role in that economy. But the overwhelming reason, because you have those kind of problems in other countries as well, the main reason was the uncertainty about the durability of this deal as a result of Donald Trump constantly signaling that he might just kill the deal. If you were a bank, you're not in it because you want to see political change. You're not in it for charity. You're in it to make money. If you are seeing an investment that's going to take 5 to 7 years, you need to have a sense of security that this deal is going to last that long, because you don't want to end up in a situation in which your investment gets sanctioned and that you lose all your money. And Trump has deliberately made sure that every time he renews waivers or does something that prolongs the life of the nuclear deal, he nevertheless does something to signal that he might go in the opposite direction as well. And he has also decertified the nuclear deal 3 months ago. That sends signals to the investment community that it's not safe going into Iran, because you just don't know if you're going to get sanctioned by Donald Trump or not. That's kept a lot of the investments out. Without investments, the Rouhani government has not succeeded in creating enough jobs. Without jobs, you have a very, very unhappy, particularly youth population. And it's not a surprise necessarily that eventually this would lead to protests of this kind. What is perhaps a bit more surprising is that it happened only 7 months after 70% of the Iranian population went out and re-elected Rouhani, 57%.
If it's not that surprising, do you think this is an intentional? Do you think it's intentional to? If there is not the political will to scuttle the agreement, the next best thing for those people who are looking for some type of regime change in Iran is to make the benefits of the agreement unstable or, ephemeral.
Oh, this is completely deliberate. I mean, I can tell you, I've been sitting in a meeting in which one Republican operative said that this is the best situation for the United States. It doesn't pay the cost of killing the deal, which would be significant, but it manages to make sure that the Iranians get no benefit from the agreement. And as a result, eventually the Iranians will pull out, the deal will collapse, which is what some folks in the U.S. side want, but it will collapse without the fault falling on the shoulders of the United States nor the cost. So without killing the deal, he is still making sure that the deal is getting killed.
Fascinating. Trita Parsi, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Trita Parsi is the president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.